Welcome to the October podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinsham. The October issue is on the topic of the management of plagiocephaly. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Mark Krieger of the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, California, speaks with Dr. David Bauer of Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire. They discuss Dr. Bauer and colleagues' article, Orthotic Therapy in Treatment of Plagiocephaly.
Hello, I'd like to welcome everybody to the October podcast on positional plagiocephaly and helmet therapy. This is associated with the neurosurgical focus issue on plagiocephaly and skull deformities. My name is Mark Krieger. I am an associate professor of neurosurgery at the Keck School of Medicine of the University of Southern California and the director of pediatric neurosurgery at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. I'm joined today with David Bauer, who is an assistant professor of surgery and pediatrics at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth, and he works at Children's Hospital of Dartmouth. Welcome, David.
Oh, hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So today's topic is in reference to your published paper on orthotic helmet therapy in the treatment of plagiocephaly. This is a joint project with multiple folks over at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and the Children's Hospital. Positional plagiocephaly is a very interesting topic. As our audience most likely knows, this really wasn't seen before the 1990s, but with the advent of the Back to Sleep program, we saw a significant drop in sudden infant death syndrome, but we did see an associated increase of deformational plagiocephaly. Along with this increase in deformational plagiocephaly, we also saw increased use of head molding orthoses to address that, and it is this topic that's addressed in Dr. Bauer's paper and that we'll be discussing today. So, David, as a start, could you please tell us, how would you assess a child with a skull asymmetry?
We have a clinic at Dartmouth where we have shared decision-making with our families. We'll have the children come in with their parents, and we'll sort of look across the room and see how asymmetric the skull looks at first glance. Then we'll do standard anthropometric measurements to look for the severity of the brachycephaly or the skull asymmetry. And then we'll go through a series of questions asking about torticollis, and we'll evaluate for torticollis. We, of course, will need to exclude actual cranial synostosis, which we will occasionally see in our plagiocephaly clinic. And then we'll ask about problems with birth or being a hypotonic baby. And then we'll talk to the parents and find out their take on how asymmetric their child's head is. We'll have some parents who have had a family member or a friend, the child in a helmet, who have a slight asymmetry and really want to have helmet therapy. And on the other side, we'll sometimes have kids come in with parents who think the child's head looks great, but the pediatrician is worried.
It's very interesting. So you covered a lot of information in there. Maybe by way of background, you could tell us a little bit about what positional plagiocephaly is.
So this is where you have skull deformation that is positional, where the child may be lying in one position for a period of time that will create asymmetry of the skull because the sutures are not yet fused.
And how do you distinguish that from cranial synostosis?
A variety of methods. Often you can distinguish the difference between plagiocephaly and synostosis by feeling for palpable ridges or by seeing an obvious metopic or sagittal ridge or the harlequin eye deformity with the unicoronal. Sometimes it's less obvious and we'll need to order either plain skull films or possibly a CT with 3D reconstructions.
Right. And what is the association with torticollis and plagiocephaly?
So there's a pretty high association, and this deals with torticollis turning the head to one side or the other and then having sustained pressure on that side of the skull. And so often by correcting the torticollis, then you can correct the plagiocephaly.
So if you see a child with a skull deformity and you decide that it's plagiocephaly and not craniosynostosis, mm-hmm. could you maybe describe the thought process in the evaluation to us?
It depends on the severity of the plagiocephaly. If it's mild plagiocephaly, then often doing repositioning therapy, neck exercises, talking with the parents and seeing if they keep the child in a, you know, car seat, you know, carrier for a long period of time, or is the child getting tummy time? And if these things aren't happening, then often, especially if you catch it early, you can do the positioning therapy and it will correct itself. If it's a more severe plagiocephaly, then we'll have a decision tree. If we catch it early, then we will always try conservative treatments such as the neck exercises and a repositioning, but we will have close follow-up with the child in clinic, and we're more apt to prescribe a helmet for helmet therapy correction. If it's a more mild plagiocephaly and maybe in an older child, then we'll be less worried, and we know that the helmet therapy doesn't work quite as well in older children, especially over a year, although it has been used in children up to 18 months of age.
So I should mention, your paper essentially is a literature review, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that you came up with 21 primary research articles that discuss this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you would agree that the literature makes recommendations, but it's the class of data is probably not particularly strong.
No, it's not. And that's why our current practice is this shared decision-making with the family. When you think about the plagiocephaly, worst things, you know, that could happen would be the child can't fit in standard bike helmets or football helmets, and so, or, you know, it'd be difficult to wear glasses. Things like that are ways that we talk to the parents about, besides being a cosmetic issue, what could be issues later on in life, you know, but it's often shared decision-making with the family.
Now, you mentioned that there may be some skull deformation issues later in life. Is there any evidence, and I know that your paper itself didn't specifically address this, but are you ever concerned about cognitive development related to positional plagiocephaly?
I'm not. It's an issue with craniosynostosis, and we, you know, address for that. But as far as plagiocephaly, I'm not aware of any cognitive issues that could have come up.
Yeah, and from my experience, I would agree with you as well. There are certainly some children with developmental delay who also have plagiocephaly, but I think most of us would agree, and correct me if it's not true, but most of us would agree that the plagiocephaly itself does not cause any sort of cognitive problems.
Oh, that's my understanding.
Now, you mentioned, the reason I brought up the literature review, you were mentioning earlier about age playing a role in the efficacy of the helmets. And so you talked about early children possibly using neck stretching exercises or physical therapy, and older children possibly progressing directly to the head molding therapy. Do you have sort of ages in mind or ages that are supported by the literature on that topic?
So our current practice is to usually place children in helmets at around 6 months of age. And obviously, some kids come older and present at an older age. And so our maximum age is around a year. Occasionally, for a case-by-case basis, we'll prescribe older, and the literature supports up to 18 months. But that's just not that common for our practice. Some children who are between maybe 3 and 4 months of age may get a helmet, but this is only if they present early with a severe deformity and we've tried physiotherapy, repositioning therapy, and it hasn't worked.
So you would always try a course of repositioning and physiotherapy before prescribing a head molding orthosis?
We will, unless it's a severe deformity and the child is maybe 6 to 8 months of age, so they're at that window where if we don't help them soon, then they may be out of the rapid growth curve of the head. So then in those kids, we may do it right off the bat.
Great. I read with interest in your article, you do talk about the fact that the helmets may have greater changes in the skull the earlier that they're using. Would you care to comment on that?
So that's referring to the rapid growth that you get. If you intuitively look at the normative head growth chart, you see the steep slope early on, and then the slope gets smaller as the child gets older. And so you're just basically trying to take advantage of that. And that basically deals with how the helmets work and whether, you know, the two types of helmets, the passive helmet and the active helmet, they both sort of work passively in the fact that you have two pressure points where you want to keep the skull from expanding rapidly, and then you have two areas where you want the head to grow into them to become more symmetric. And so that's why a rapid head growth really helps in the early correction.
It's interesting about the different types of helmets. So basically people advertise some helmets as being dynamic or actively molding helmets, but versus the more passive types of helmets. Is that correct?
That's correct.
In your review of literature, did you see a difference in the efficacy of these two types?
I did not. I know that the active helmets are newer and that maybe in new iterations that they may become different. But in my practice, I only prescribe the passive helmets. But my understanding is that with the active helmets, as you actively inflate an air bladder to put pressure on the scalp, you can only put so much pressure in before you can have skin breakdown or an ulcer form. And so in my experience with the passive helmets, we actually will look for an area of slight redness on the two pressure points on the helmet to ensure that it's fit properly and that it's working. You almost want to look for that because you know that the helmets fit properly.
Are there differences in cost between the active helmets and the passive helmets?
I don't know the exact cost, but I've been told the active are more expensive than the passive, but I don't prescribe the active in my practice, and so I don't know the direct cost.
I understand. And then how do you follow these children? So if you saw a child in your office and you do prescribe a head molding orthosis, what's the follow-up, and how do you know if you're actually helping the child?
So we do anthropometric measurements at each clinic visit, and that's a way to quantitatively determine if the asymmetry is improving with time. I follow the children on an individualized basis. If it's a severe asymmetry, then we will see the children more often in our clinic. If it's not as severe, then maybe less often. And so, again, we'll tailor the follow-up to the child.
Great. And what role do the parents' perceptions play in the outcome determination?
A big role. In the literature review, it's interesting to see the difference in parents' perception versus the actual quantitative data outcome, and sometimes they're not completely concordant. And so we definitely rely on what the parents think about their child's head shape.
Very interesting. What do you think the future holds for the treatment of positional plagiocephaly?
There are two different stories. One would be an exciting future with a dynamic helmet that's computer controlled, you know, with multiple air bladders that has pressure sensors that can actively, you know, change a child's head to the perfect shape. I think that would be great, you know, maybe controlled by your iPhone. Realistically, in my mind, to help the most kids, I mean, especially, you know, worldwide, would be to have, a one-size-fits-all helmet with easy-to-fit Velcro inserts so that anyone could prescribe helmet therapy in any part of the world. So I don't know how things will turn out. It'll be interesting to find out.
Do you think there'll be more recognition of this problem as time goes on, or you think it's sort of plateaued at this point?
You know, I hope that it becomes more recognized by pediatricians. I think the more education they give families as far as doing tummy time and repositioning therapy before the child develops cranial asymmetry could decrease the incidence. I think the Back to Sleep campaign is gone, at least through the developed world, so it's probably a problem in most developed countries that have implemented that therapy.
And one last question from my point of view. So the Back to Sleep program, just so we have the overall perspective on this, has essentially caused this problem. Would you advocate ending the Back to Sleep program?
No. It's definitely decreased the sudden infant death syndrome. And I've heard, although I didn't practice before the Back to Sleep campaign, that at that point we were having different types of plagiocephaly, maybe up front if the child was sleeping on his stomach. And so I definitely would not advocate stopping that program.
Right, and I would agree. I think it's probably saved a number of children's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. I don't have any further questions, Dr. Barrett.
It was great talking with you, Mark.
Likewise, I really appreciate your paper. It's really an important paper in the field, as it sums up the articles that have been published about this topic in, I think, a very cogent and succinct fashion. I'd certainly recommend it to our readership.
Okay, great.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate everyone's attention.
This concludes our podcast for the October issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the November issue, when the topic will be Controversies in Movement Disorder Surgery.